Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. Alex Salmond has pulled out of the evidence session he was due to appear in front of in the Scottish Parliament committee tomorrow on the grounds that the Scottish Parliament has pulled and censored the evidence that he gave. In this extraordinary development, it now doesn't look likely that his investigations against Nicola Sturgeon are going to be investigated at all. I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by Katie Bowles and James Forsyth. Now, James, anybody who's tried to follow the Alex Salmond saga will have failed. It's so convoluted. But why should you care if you don't live in Scotland?
I think you should care hugely because in a part of the United Kingdom, you have got an extraordinary development today, which raises, I think, big questions about the separation of powers, which is that the Crown Office, which is headed by a member of the Scottish Government, pressured the Scottish Parliament to redact Alex Salmond's evidence, to remove this explosive charge that Nicola Sturgeon broke the ministerial code. The significance of this is that Alex Salmond and his lawyers have long been concerned that unless this evidence is published, if he were to speak about it at the inquiry, he could put himself in legal jeopardy because of a complicated question of whether the evidence could be used to identify some of the complainants against him in the criminal case on which he was acquitted about his sexual behaviour. There is a judicial review that the Scottish Government lost. There is the question of whether the First Minister misled the Scottish Parliament. And you have pressure being put on by the Crown Office on the Scottish Parliament to redact a document that they had previously published and therefore make it far more difficult for Alex Salmond to discuss this very serious allegation. It is worth remembering, now Priti Patel was obviously an exception to this, that the normal rule is a breach of the ministerial code in the UK system is considered a kind of automatic resigning offence. For the First Minister to be accused of breaching the ministerial code by her predecessor is a very serious business. It is worth remembering that Henry McLeish resigned as First Minister of Scotland over a relatively small irregularity in his expenses because it was perceived to, was found to have broken the ministerial code.
He called it a muddle, not a fiddle at the time.
Yes.
But the muddle was enough to get him fired.
Yeah.
But Nicola Sturgeon, let's be clear here, what she's accused of is getting her dates slightly wrong.
Alex Salmond doesn't use the word himself, but Alex Salmond is essentially saying that Nicola Sturgeon and those around him attempted to use a malicious prosecution to remove Alex Salmond from public life. In our political system, that is about as explosive a charge as you can get. I find it is a bit naff, and I apologise as a kind of token Englishman with two Scots to always bring things to comparisons to Westminster.
I thought you were going to say cricket for a bit.
No, the accusation is like Theresa May saying that Boris Johnson and his aides and allies had cooked up a criminal case against Theresa May because they were finding her criticisms of the government over planning reform or airports reopening a bit difficult. It is an incredibly serious charge from Alex Salmond, and I think it's an incredibly serious charge that needs to be examined properly.
But Katie, James has cooked up a charge there. We all...
Alex Salmond says they cooked up, yeah.
Well, sure, but the thing is, the Alex Salmond, he went to court, he was found not guilty of the offences, but there was no doubt that his behaviour left something to be desired here. So I imagine Nicola Sturgeon would say it's absolutely right that these charges ought to have been brought. Sure, a court found him not guilty, but there was nothing wrong, nothing dishonourable. In fact, there was a moral duty to pursue the evidence where it led, and the Scottish Crown Office decided to go ahead with the prosecution. So that part of it is pretty difficult to find any corruption there. Alex Salmond might argue now that this was a case to frame him. I think the words he uses is to a case to imprison him by Nicola Sturgeon and her husband, Peter Morrell, the SNP chief executive. But right now, we are just really looking at Nicola Sturgeon's version of events. And she says her meeting happens on this day, it might have happened on the other day. Is that really enough to bring her down as First Minister? Because that, realistically, that's all that this inquiry is going to find out.
Well, I think if she was seen to have misled Scottish Parliament, then that's ultimately something which is going to be very difficult for her. But I do get the sense when you're talking to Scottish Tories, when you're talking to various politicians in Scotland and those around Scottish Parliament, they don't expect this to be the killer blow to the First Minister in terms of her career. However, they do expect this to make life difficult for her, make things uncomfortable and add to a series of problems that SNP are facing. Now, Alex Salmond has suggested he's not going to give evidence tomorrow. We just heard he might give evidence on Thursday. There is a moving picture there. I think that public opinion, if you remove this incident, but you look at, I suppose, approval of Alex Salmond as a figure and Nicola Sturgeon as a figure in Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon has a much better public approval. So I think if we're going to move to the how this is seen by voters, it's clearly not beneficial for Nicola Sturgeon. It is damaging. But I do get the sense that it is when you speak to those who would like to see the SNP not do as well as they are currently doing, they see it as one of several things that could damage them rather than the fact that they actually think she is seriously going to end up resigning over it.
Katie is clearly right that Alex Salmond is not a popular politician in Scotland anymore. His ratings there are worse than Boris Johnson. And Fraser, you're clearly right that Alex Salmond's behaviour as his own QC was found missing on a train. It was without doubt ungentlemanly, and someone who is First Minister of Scotland should not be behaving in the way that he was behaving.
But ungentlemanly is quite a... He did push it a wee bit far.
It was disgraceful, right? I mean, yeah, it conduct unbecoming of
any citizen. Anyway.
Yeah. But the point here is, I think the allegations being raised here in Alex Salmond's testimony, these are the most serious charges made against a politician since the Jeremy Thorpe trial. This is a massive issue. And I think there is a massive issue here, which is that the Scottish Parliament has backed off publishing a document that it had already published in the face of executive. I mean, this is one of the biggest political stories that we will ever cover in our lifetime, with perhaps some of the most profound constitutional implications. Because if what Salmond is alleging, if it is true, and we do not know whether it is true, this is why it is so important that it is aired and discussed, it would suggest that Scotland is essentially a failed state.
In what way?
Because it is suggesting that the executive can work with the prosecuting services to use the law to try and remove a political opponent from the field of battle.
That's the accusation.
That is the Salmond accusation. No, but that is about the most explosive accusation you can have in a liberal democracy. You know, I mean, that is alleging the kind of behaviour that you see when Alexei Navalny is prosecuted in Moscow on some trumped-up charge. I mean, this is an incredible... I mean, the seriousness of Salmond's charge is incredible. Now, you can argue that the Salmond charge is so serious, come on, the real world doesn't operate like that. But I certainly think that you need to have this investigated fully and properly. And I think it's very odd that the Scottish Parliament... The committee voted on whether the evidence should be published or not on party lines. It then went to the corporate body of the Scottish Parliament. Their job is to think about the kind of overall importance of the Parliament above party. They decided to publish it. You then had this pressure from the Crown Office, led by a member of the Scottish Government, to redact the document, which has stymied the inquiry's ability to hear Alex Salmond's views on this. And I think it's incredibly important these views are heard, either for them to be found to be wrong, but they need to be looked at. I mean, this is...
Alex Salmond himself is the one who has decided to pull out. I mean, you say, James, that he felt that unless they published his evidence, he would be exposed, that he might be prosecuted for going out of turn. But he might not, and ultimately it is his decision, surely. He is the one who's censoring himself in this particular equation.
Yes, but he is arguing that if he is expected to appear without this document being published, he is being asked to put himself in legal jeopardy, which he is saying is not a reasonable position for the Parliament to take. I think the point is that the seriousness of the Salmond charge, I think, means that it needs to be exposed to the utmost scrutiny. And if what Salmond is accusing, which is remarkable in its extent, surely if you think this is all made up out of plain cloth, you should want the greatest spotlight shone on these claims so that they can be exposed.
Now, Katie, will this have much cut through? I mean, it does to us. I'm Scottish, you're Scottish, James is spiritually Scottish. But to your average English voter, even beginning to get their head around this. People haven't heard of such a thing as the Crown Office. Even the vocabulary leaves your average voter cold. There is an election which is going to start in 4 weeks. That's when the postal voting starts for Holyrood. I'm wondering if this is going to move the dial in England or even in Scotland, really.
I mean, I think you can see with every day that goes by, interest is increasing in this story. Now, obviously, there's journalists as a group. I think that journalists in Westminster and beyond are now very interested in the story. In terms of your average passerby on the street, I do think this is something which is rising up in terms of importance. And I think from the Scotland perspective, I think that Scottish Tories were initially quite downbeat a few months ago on this, in the sense that it was not having much cut through at all. I think there was talk for a long period of time about this idea that the SNP were going to be dented soon and the salmon inquiry is going to be really difficult for Nicola Sturgeon. And yet when it started to occur, actually it looked as though it might have been overhyped in terms of the impact it would have. I think that partly recent events, you look at the Spectator action on this, as well as other parts of this, if we get the testimony, means that it's now becoming a much more live issue. And I think that just as it's becoming more prominent in Scotland, it means that there is more attention being paid here. But clearly, there is a limit in the sense that, although as James makes a compelling case why it is such an important event for anyone, I think the fact that ultimately many English voters or all English voters cannot vote for the SNP means that there is a limit on how far it is going to have cut through.
And meanwhile, if you look, Katie, at what the Union Unit number 10 is doing, it's looking for its third leader in the space of, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks. There seems to be chaos in Edinburgh, certainly, but implosion in Westminster.
Yes, but this is what happened at the end of last week, where you had Oliver Lewis step down as head of the Union Unit. He had been in the job a grand total of 2 weeks. And now I think there's questions as to whether they actually do get a direct replacement for Oliver Lewis.
Or just disband the unit, is that being
discussed? Yeah, you could de-dramatise the unit, is one way of putting it. It fades off into the distance. It's seen as a little bit of a cursed job these days, I think, the Union Unit job. And as a result, you could instead have figures in number 10, such as Henry Newman, the senior number 10 advisor, who influence the policy, and when union policy comes to number 10, they oversee it, but you don't have a specific union unit advisor per se, which I think would be partly down to how union policy is going to be divided across government, but also the fact that because number 10 has become so factional recently, I think there is a small element of this, which is perhaps it is simpler just not to announce new people to roles right now when there is so much anger around.
But personal aside, what this boils down to is that the SNP is in as much trouble as a party could be in. Voting starts in a matter of weeks. And still, the Tories, Scottish Tories or British Tories, are all at odds and of no real direction when it comes to fighting for the union, a battle which has pretty much started.
Yeah, I think we have a situation where the Scottish Tories, led by Douglas Ross, are very much doing their own thing. Yes, they liaise with Westminster, but I think they are ignoring what's happening in terms of the number 10 drama. But when you speak to ministers, in terms of the number 10 strategy on the union, I think there is deep confusion, particularly after the Oliver Lewis departed. And I think that if you were going to say this is a policy priority, I think that if we all called up, a couple of ministers each and asked them what the exact strategy is, even if people tried to answer it, it wouldn't match up, which is worrying.
Now, James, we also had Nicola Sturgeon detail her way out of lockdown this morning, a path which is a bit slower than one Boris Johnson laid out yesterday, but not much slower. There's something that you spotted in the press conference last night, and that was the hint that people are going to be required to have the vaccine to keep their jobs in certain environments.
Yeah, so Chris Whitty was asked about this, and he said that he thought it was the professional responsibility of doctors, nurses and social care workers to get the jab, because it would help protect the vulnerable people that they look after. Boris Johnson then followed it up by saying that some very high quality care homes were looking at how they can ensure that all their staff have the jab. I thought that was the clearest indication yet that the government is considering allowing health and social care settings to have a kind of contractual obligation on employees, to take the vaccine. Now,
perfectly sensible in your view, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's not an unreasonable policy, given that this is the area where you would be exposing people to the most risk, we require people who want to go to medical school to take the hepatitis B vaccine, for example. Do we think that's... would we reverse that? Is that an unreasonable... You know, the idea you can't do a medical degree in the UK unless you have your hepatitis B vaccine, is that unreasonable?
Right.
And so...
But this, it isn't the argument against it, the slippery slope.
I agree. I completely agree that once you start saying that to work in this setting, you have to allow this a substance to be injected into your body, right? I obviously understand that you are crossing a line. So it is a line that we have already crossed in one respect. But I also think there is a clear difference between Pimlico plumbers and the setting of a care home. I mean, you know, there are one of the two. And I also think that, I think this, look, I'm lucky neither of my parents are in care homes. I don't have any elder relatives in the care home. But I do think that given that no vaccine is 100% effective, is it completely unreasonable to expect people working with people who are particularly vulnerable to this virus to take every step to protect themselves? Now, I find it far harder to see the justification for Pimlico plumbers saying that you have to have had a jab to come and fix someone's boiler, right? But in situations which inevitably involved prolonged close contact, I'm not saying I'm in favour of it, but I'm not saying I'm against it. We have already done this in one area. And would any of us reverse that policy? Would any of us say, you can go to medical school even if you don't want to have a hepatitis B vaccine?
Okay. And Katie, from the conversations you've had today, what do you think the mood is like now that people have had a 24 hours to reflect on Boris Johnson's new timetable? I know that for, to give a random example, young ladies about to get married, it might be quite good news because we hear that in July, it's all, you're going to have a wedding for 400 or something. We can if you want that.
I think you could have it, but the question is, could you afford it? So I'd have to talk about my salary, perhaps. But no, I mean, I think that if you look at the parliamentary party, it's one of probably reluctant acceptance in terms of the deal, I would say, broadly speaking, in the sense that it does go slower than most would like. The COVID recovery group, Steve Baker, Mark Harper, would like it to go a lot faster.
But they're being quite quiet, aren't they? They're not really being aggressively attacking the government. It almost looks as if a deal was struck with them before the announcement.
Well, they made a few points on it soon after the announcement. I think one of the things you're hearing is this idea that if the data gets better, given Boris Johnson is saying the whole strategy is data-led, if the data gets better, could you move faster? Now, the minister currently saying no. I think that will pick up as an approach if we do start to see real improvements from the vaccines and people want to move faster. But other than the COVID recovery group, I mean, Boris Johnson addressed MPs last night in a Zoom call after doing the press conference. And broadly speaking, people say it was a very positive atmosphere. There were some congratulations again on the vaccine programme. One MP actually invited Boris Johnson to their wedding, which can now go ahead. And I think that overall, I think because Boris Johnson has put this date on by which all restrictions could go by the summer, that has prevented a large-scale Tory rebellion for now. Now, if these reviews on one being vaccine passports, but the other being social distancing, so things like masks, the 1-metre-plus rule, ahead of the stage 4 mass relaxation, start to add lots of caveats on, so, you know, you can have unlimited number of people in this venue, but you have to keep 2 metres apart, I think you'll start to see this pick up again. But ultimately, where Boris Johnson, I think, would have been trouble of his party is the sense of constant restrictions, and at the moment they're giving him the benefit of the doubt that by going slowly you are going to get to a point of freedom as you might define it in a dictionary.
I mean, it's fascinating, you were talking about the differences between the Sturgeon plan and the Boris Johnson plan. That is the biggest difference. Nicola Sturgeon has avoided giving any end date. Boris Johnson has gone for this June the 21st, the last day of spring, the restrictions go. Now, as Katie said, we don't know what happens to social distancing and the like. June 21st, nightclubs are meant to be reopened. It would be a fairly odd nightclub with a kind of 1-metre-plus rule in place, right? And I think that Katie is totally right, that the reason the Tory backbench reaction has been more muted than you'd expect. I think if you'd said to any of us a week or so ago, they're going to say that you won't get into a pub until May, this inside a pub until May the 17th. We would have thought, oh my word, people will kick off about that. But I think that it's that June 21st date and the prospect that, you know, unlike rationing after the Second World War, these restrictions aren't going to run on for years. There might be a big bang moment in which they all go. That is what is, I think, keeping Tory MPs, I would say, mild disappointment rather than reluctant approval, but I don't think those are two radically different concepts. I think that is what is keeping them on the reservation, I would say.
So, Katie, when can we invite readers for drinks in the Spectator Garden?
So from the end of March, we can have outdoor groups of six. So if it's, you know, us three, actually, and Cindy, who's producing this podcast, then we can have two guests over. And then from May 17th, we can have gatherings outdoor of up to 30 people.
Right. So that, then we can invite listeners of this podcast to come and...
get in touch.
Well, listen, if you'd like to come along, then... drop us a line to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Katie and James, thanks very much. And thanks for listening. And thanks to Cindy Yu, our producer.